Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for April's Exotics Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome back to Webinar Club our speaker for today, lecturer and clinical manager at the Exotic Animal and Wildlife Clinic at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies, University of Edinburgh, Kevin Eatwell. Thank you, Kevin. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, and welcome to today's webinar. And today we're going to be going through looking at gastrointestinal stasis in rabbits and how we approach those cases. I think it's quite a complicated thing and certainly something that's seen very commonly in practice. And I like this slide really to some extent because it says if you have a sick or a painful rabbit that going off food, going into GI stasis are sort of consequences of that, and obviously all progressing down to death is something that we do see, and I think that sort of flags up the importance paying attention, if you like, to the GI tract function for any case that you see, really, because all the cases we see are sick or painful. So we want to get things done right by these as patients, and that does mean we have to manage them significantly differently from dogs or cats, really, when we're dealing with them. So we do have to be aware that we can upset this very, very system very, very easily. The hindgut, like I say, is a major component of their digestion. And really, the whole sort of system is designed for a high-fiber diet, so there's quite a rapid gut transit time. Where they are pushing fibre through the system. Generally, they're eating in the morning, evening, and overnight. So in a lot of cases, when these patients are with you during the day, means that they maybe aren't doing the range of activities that you like. It's first thing in the morning after they've been hospitalised that you're really going to get a good feel for what they've been doing overnight. Rabbits normally, due to the risk of predation, aren't selective feeders. They will basically fill their bellies. And once they get to the point of being full, they then may turn into being more selective feeders once they've got the time to do so. And we know that stress, pain, will all influence motility of the GI tract. And even if you've got a rabbit presenting in and it's not presenting with GI disease, this will become a problem if you don't manage it accordingly. So we actually, for the patients that come into the clinic here in Edinburgh, we actually routinely treat every rabbit that comes in, irrespective of the condition. So we have a little look at what GI tract we're talking about here. We start off with the stomach, which is quite thin-walled, quite poorly distensible, although can distend to quite a size, and we will come on to that during our discussion. There's always food in there, secretose, which they've re-ingested from the hindgut, and there'll always be a bit of hair knocking around as well within that as well. Very acidic pH, higher pH sort of around weaning sort of stage, and that's where we see a lot of genuine enteric infections in the weanlings. You then have a very basic, simple small intestine. Material is then passed straight on into the cecum. And really, the hindgut of the rabbit is responsible for the sorting of ingesta. Bacterial and protozoal fermentation will go on. You've got the sacculus rotundus, which is an area that's rich in lymphoid tissue. Your cecum is 40% of the gut volume, and that basically is sacculated, and that's really where the bulk of the fermentation occurs. And the contents of that are sort of a doughy, semi-sort of solid in nature on there. And at the end of that, you then have an appendix, which is also very rich in lymphoid tissue as well. But again, that's just a blind-ending pouch at the end. And if we just have a little look here at just a dissection point, this really is your small intestine popping into ampulla coli or sacculus rotundus here. You then have cecum followed by appendix. Then you've got the proximal colon, which is haustrated with sacculated, moving down to the distal colon, which obviously is smooth all the way down. And basically within the colon, that this is able to separate the digestible and indigestible fiber. With the Fusus coli coordinating this. And what this does is it moves the ingestible fibre rapidly which is excreted as hard fecal pellets, which obviously we all know and see. And then you have movement pushing the digestible fibre particles back into the cecum for fermentation. And generally, 3 to 8 hours after eating, you'll get mucusy covered cecal pellets expelled from the anus, which the rabbit eats reflexly, it's called cecotrophy, and this then basically makes all that energy available during the second pass on digestion available for the rabbit. And again, really what we're talking about here, the take-home message from here really is that we've got indigestible fibre being pushed out, digestible fibre being brought back through. These are your cecotrophs the rabbit should be eating, and there's a variety of reasons they might not. And this is more normal fecal pellets that are being produced at the end. So cecum is very important. Fermentation vat and lots of things can upset that fermentation, and that can be a sudden change in diet, for example, may do that as one example for you. A lot of anaerobes, bacteria, some yeast, protozoa here involved as well. And obviously this population is very sensitive to what food it's given and the pH of the cecum. So fiber is the driver for motility, a variety of hormones that can have an effect. And obviously having high carbohydrate-based diet can obviously inhibit motility as well with that. So it's a fiber that they need to get everything functioning in terms of motility. So to keep our rabbits healthy, the most important thing we can do is to feed them the correct diet. That's fairly basic. This is a sort of a key selling point in your post-purchase examination or during your vaccinations to ensure that people are feeding their rabbits accordingly. They're grazing herbivores, so surprise, surprise, we've got to look at trying to mimic this sort of diet in captivity. So we're looking at substituting grass, really, I guess is what we're doing here. Grass is quite high fibre, relatively low fat, quite high protein. Your commercial pelleted diets are normally much higher in protein and fat, and the fiber content's much lower down there as well. And so we need to sort of realize that these really are something that should be fed in very limited amounts. And obviously we also have the issue that these could selectively feed on muesli style mixes as well, which obviously we know are directly related now to obesity and all sorts of other things in the rabbits as well. So your best diet really is to try and go for grass and hay, some leafy greens, and indeed rabbits don't necessarily need to have an extruded pelleted diet, that sort of type thing. But we actually quite like offering those, and the simple reason rabbits tend to want to eat them, they're motivated by that, and so we actually use them as moments for pet owner bonding. But equally, if I'm going out to feed my rabbits before I rush out to work in the morning and I've got a little pot of pellets that I am rattling, maybe just a teeny tiny amount, that rabbit should be rushing forward to take those pellets from me. And if I know it's rushed forward and taken those pellets, then I know the rabbit can't be feeling too bad. If that rabbit decides not to come up and have its tasty treated pellets from me, then obviously something has gone wrong, and that's a way of flagging up the fact that the rabbit isn't quite so healthy. So we need to all practice and get good at doing our clinical assessment of the GI tract. And really here you're reliant on the clinical history in terms of eating, drinking, fecal and urinary output from the owner. Clinical assessment from palpation is important. Auscultation is important as well. If the rabbit is stressed and scared, you might not get cecal flushes, which you should be getting sort of one every 30 seconds really. You want to be able to palpate the stomach, okay, quarter to rib cage, and having a good feel of that. If that's becoming tympanic or distended, we need to be aware of that. Cecum will really be on the ventral right-hand side. You'll feel a doughy sort of feel to that, and you should also be able to feel fecal pellets in your colon. Beyond that, it's very difficult to palpate proximal colon distinctly, and also quite difficult to palpate small intestine as a distinct entity as well. And I guess really there's one important question that you need to be answering on the basis of your clinical assessment of one of these cases, and that is, do I have a rabbit that is genuinely blocked, or is this a GI stasis case? And that's the distinction that we really need to try and make. Look at the whole rabbit, and if you do have a rabbit that is blocked, and I label these now as a potential surgical candidate, then you will have obvious stomach bloating, obvious tympani, and pain present. And you'll probably have a rabbit that with an acute deterioration in clinical signs that was doing okay and then suddenly went downhill. And when you think about it, what we're looking at here is this rabbit is capable of blocking of the pyloric outflow or anywhere along the length of its small intestine, right the way down to the saculus rotundus. And you're most likely, the most significant likely cause for this blockage is going to be a fur pelt. So your questions of is the rabbit molting? What are they doing? Do they groom it? Does it have a friend? Is it over-grooming the friend? All that sort of thing is of significance. And rabbits can have a significant amount of fur that they ingest that works its way through the system on an hourly basis, really. And it's just a question of chances of whether some of that blocks or slows down the transit. So really, I think there's a few clinical presentations that you're going to get. You're going to have a normal abdomen, maybe no GI sounds because they're scared. You look at your history, and if it's eating, drinking, weeing, and pooing, great, this is a normal rabbit. You may also have a rabbit that's got a normal palpation, but it's just less full than you would like, and that can be due to reduction in food intake, but not anorexia necessarily, or maybe recent anorexia, but not a primary GI thing. Post-surgery, for example, is a classical time that you'll palpate these and go, well, that's less than normal, but nevertheless, there's stuff there. You may then have genuine cecal tympani, impacted cecum with full of firm material. You might have a gastric dilation with some tympani which feels solid, and you may then have some gastric dilatation, but still it's compressible and a little bit doughy as well, despite that. And that's really is what you're going to be finding clinically. So if they're anorexic, as far as I'm concerned, that prompts them to need veterinary assessment. So they need to come in. We worry consequences from anorexia is going to be gastrointestinal stasis, hepatic lipidosis, ketoacidosis, can lead to death if left untreated. So an anorexic rabbit is one that we're going to recommend is seen in the clinic. Obese rabbits are more prone to getting fatty liver changes, things like that. And obviously a lot of our pet rabbits are obese as well. So we do have to be aware of that. And you may have underlying liver disease that just hasn't really been detected by you clinically. And unless the liver is markedly enlarged, you also cannot palpate it because it's normally pushed right underneath the rib cage and hidden out of the way. So you will see hyperglycemia in these cases when they're progressing in severe metabolic crisis. And certainly we'll come back to the discussion on glucose for you in terms of our thoughts on that really. But obviously if you're looking at ketoacidosis, a fairly classical ketone smelling, acidic urine, they're depressed, disorientated, ataxic, this sort of type thing really can be quite sick by the time they're presented. And so this continues quite markedly downhill. Gas buildup causes anorexia due to pain, stomach contents and gut contents dry out as well, which decreases motility. They'll become hypothermic. A lot of gut stasis rabbits are hypothermic upon presentation. If they're genuinely blocked, they can be markedly hypothermic, but most of these cases are hypothermic when you see them, and it's important to get a temperature first port of call. So there's a whole variety of things that can set this whole thing in motion, and what you need to be able to decide is whether you have got environmental factors that can be corrected here causing this, or whether you think there is a genuine medical or surgical problem that this rabbit has that maybe has predisposed it to getting repetitive bouts of GI stasis, and post-spay adhesions, for example, will be one that we would be having here. But again, pain, stress, dehydration, anorexia, really any of these things that you'll find with a sick or painful rabbit or one post-surgery, all are predisposing factors to this condition. So predators aren't great. Competition between rabbits being mean to each other, change in group hierarchy, a sudden change in the diet. Even if it's for the better, that the owner's had an awful diet, they've upgraded it, suddenly changed the feed going through the rabbit. If the rabbit is not used to digesting these products, the cecal flora will become upset. Hey presto, you're on to GI stasis straight away. Transporting a long distance. Extreme weather and temperature I put here, so the water bottle freezes, rabbit slightly dehydrates, for example. And maybe loss of a companion, or this really goes back to disruption of the group, really, where it may be a factor. So, stomach contents, there's always stomach contents, but if these become dehydrated, these become firmer, and then you may get an impaction, or you may get reduced flow of these. You may get hair present within this, which we know is there as well. That may also reduce the speed at which things are moving through the system. And really, these sort of cases, you'll see quite commonly rabbits coming through, passing a lot of fur in their feces, intermittent signs of abdominal discomfort, but things are still sort of moving through. If you get a genuine blocked fur pelt at any point along this small intestine, that pushes them into becoming surgical, I guess, but not all surgical cases end up having surgery, if that makes sense. And this is routine molting. I mean, you know, when you look at these cases and you think, oh, it's got a surgical case, let's go in and remove that. Who's to say it's not going to re-block with fur tomorrow, the day after, next week, the next time that it decides to molt, the next time its friend molts and it overgrooms it. So this is an ongoing thing, and this is management of these species, not rushing in and doing some heroic surgery. It's education from the start that's needed to try and minimize this risk. And you know, there's been a number of papers more recently looking at this, which is very, very good, looking at types of rabbits predisposed to GI stasis, which again, there's been ones in the vet record looking at that. Going through to looking at how you would medically treat some of these cases. And to be fair, some of the papers, just because they're published, doesn't mean to say they are showing best practice or would even be recommended by specialists in the field. And I think the thing to be aware of when we're looking at these gut stasis rabbits, the first thing is analgesia is critically important. These are painful, with a lot of gas working their way through, and opioids should be used as a routine. If this patient is sick enough that you want to admit it, it's on opioids. And we're using buprenorphine as standard here. And we're not worried about the effects of opioids on GI motility. I'm more worried about the pain and gas leading to reductions in GI motility. Fluid therapy important, and you need to consider IV fluid therapy in these to get that therapy on board. And to some extent, oral fluid therapy as well. We want to rehydrate the stomach contents and get that moving as well. So you've got to be very proactive on your fluid therapy here as well. And if you've got a hypothermic animal being presented, then to be fair, subcutaneous fluids are not adequate for that. If it's that painful, it's gone off food, a non-steroidal is not adequate for analgesia. When you're looking at the use of prokinetics and assist feeding, then this, of course, is something you have to bear in mind and balancing, verging with a rabbit that's getting a genuine obstruction or you think might be obstructed. There is no point piling more food into an already tympanic stomach, risking increased distension and pain. Motility is your problem, not lack of food in the first place in these sort of cases. So with these, rehydration of the animal and rehydrating contents maybe is more important. But bear in mind, if you do have a blockage in your intestine, you get a retention of stomach fluid your gut contents in your stomach are bathing in fluid. So for these, analgesia is critically important. Rehydrating them parenterally is important. Getting them normothermic and not hypothermic is important. All these things that you would want to do before going into surgery anyway, you should be doing to this patient. And in our experience, in a very high percentage of those, you then don't need to go for surgery because the blockage moves, at which point you can start pushing prokinetics at them and you can carry on treating them as they are. If the blockage doesn't move, they become a surgical candidate, but obviously you've got to stabilize them in the first instance. So we like our buprenorphine for these, we like our meloxicam for these, and we use ranitidine because it's antacid anyway, and it has an effect on hindgut movement, so that's kind of what we do. For placing a catheter in rabbits is easy as you like. They're going to have ear veins sitting there, marginal ear veins, and you actually can use either side of the ear if you need to. And if you had a lot of catheters before, they'll create new veins. So sometimes your veins will be spreading across the ear here if the marginal ear vein has become clotted with the catheter and is no longer functional. But basically, we put Emla on these to numb them out, give them a clean. We're sliding a catheter in with a bung in place, 26 or 24 gauge, depending on the size of the rabbit. And that then is being just very gently bound in. We're using a gauze swab to hold the ear up to stop it kinking, to keep the catheter straight, bandaging these in, and it works very, very well for these guys for intermittent boluses. We tend not to use an IV line unless the rabbit is very moribund, because they're just going to chew through it and you'll get them bleeding back out of the catheter. So we tend to use boluses for these, which works very, very well. Your assist feeding, again, not going into too much detail today because we're talking more about the deciding factors between surgery and medicine really here. But obviously, if you're convinced they're not blocks, getting food in is very useful. Oxbow, all the Suprema ones we use as standard for these, to start pushing the content through, to start getting this hair out of their system and replace it with stuff that's easy to digest and move through. And obviously, as part of these, we're also grooming them as well when we're trying to get rid of any remaining hair from the rabbit whilst it's in with us while we have the chance. So if you're going to try and decide when are they surgical, there's lots of things looking at things like blood glucose. And we do know that hypoglycemia increases as your prognosis deteriorates. And of course, if you've got a blockage, you're going to be in poor condition, as we've said. I don't feel, however, that blood glucose in its own right is a useful indicator for deciding when you operate on a rabbit or not. It's useful to assess metabolic status of that patient, which then maybe is an indicator of maybe I should do something better to stabilize you more appropriately. But I wouldn't say it is relevant for making a deciding factor on do you need to have surgery or not. The assessment has to be far more in depth and comprehensive than that. And we also know that hyponatremia has a direct correlation with death in the rabbits as well. And that, again, is just the other side of the same spectrum. If your glucose is going up, sodium is dropping down. This is an evaluation of the metabolic status of the patient presenting to you, not necessarily saying, oh, by the way, this animal has a blockage. It might not have a blockage. It might have a severe ketoacidosis. But the fact of the matter is your glucose and your sodium is simply saying, this rabbit is in crisis. It's not a deciding factor on surgery. And if you are really that concerned about the metabolic status and the ketoacidosis of your rabbit and whether it's ventilating effectively, etc., then just do arterial blood gas. If you're that worried, let's do it properly and evaluate arterial blood gas on this patient. And then when we're titrating our fluid therapy, we can work out exactly if we need to add bicarbonate to that, whether we need to consider adding some insulin in to try and force some glucose back into the cells, this sort of type thing, and so on and so forth. So if you're going to do it, do it properly. They have an artery sitting in that ear. You've just put your catheter in. It's sitting right there. A lot of facilities now where you're using, for example, an iStat or other in-house analyzers, you've got instant access to arterial blood gas in the rabbits. And of course, we do have an idea now of what is normal for these patients. And so we're in a position now to titrate our fluid therapy exactly based on the metabolic status of that patient to get it stabilized. And then, if we're finding it genuinely has a blockage on our clinical assessment or radiography, more than likely, then we've got it in the best state for surgery. So basically, all your glucose and sodium and blood gas are doing is saying, I'm in crisis, help me out. It doesn't say I need surgery. And really, for me, it's clinical assessment and radiography that determine the need for surgery or otherwise. So a classic gastric stasis rabbit is having dehydrated contents, which are pulling back from the stomach lining, with gas formation due to fermentation around that, and you very clearly get a gas halo with drying up stomach contents on these medical cases that are not blocked. And you can get a varying amount. I mean, this is a lovely, massive cecal tympani here as well in this particular case, which is not helping. But classical gut stasis radiograph. And with these, you can lie them down with sandbags, which seems to work quite well. You just got to put sufficient pressure to get a decent lateral, and that's probably good enough in the real clinical sort of setting. And again, just some more showing you the differences in these. But really, what we're looking for is size of stomach. Is there a halo? Can I see the granular food within this? Where is my gas in terms of colon or cecum? And just really trying to quantify severity here. On this particular one now, we've got more gas coming in here, quite a distended stomach here, but again, no real fluid, more gas in small intestine too, working through. When you're looking at a surgical case, then I'm going to show you a surgical picture now, or a potential surgical candidate is how I would label them. This creature has a clear gastric dilatation. It's got fluid trapped in the stomach, which is not being cleared because of a blockage, with a gas tap floating on top of that. And you can't see the digestion because you've got gastric fluid being retained. It is important to realize that in 1 hour's time, this patient might suddenly transform to being non-surgical because that fur pelt might move spontaneously or move in response to your supportive care where you're analgesing that patient and rehydrating things as well. And your blood glucose of these patients also markedly fluctuates. And I'd argue if they are in crisis, it goes up, and as they improve and stabilize again, it goes down again. You know, it is a variable feast as you're going through this process, but it's the radiography that's making and clinical assessment that's making me decide if this is a surgical case or not. But this is a classical surgical case, big distended stomach here, fluid filled. I can't identify ingester. No gas back here. This hasn't got gas anywhere else in its GI tract. It's got a blockage in the small intestine somewhere, with a gas cap on top. If this continues despite stabilization, then it's surgical. If during stabilization that material moves, this stomach content will drain into the small intestine and the stomach size will reduce. Another gut stasis case here. We've got classical stomach appearance. We've got proximal colon gas, which you can see, which is the bit that looks like a monster munch. Cecal gas as well. You know, absolutely classical sort of GI stasis case. Another one here, cecal gas. Another case here, cecal gas is now actually pushed forward in here. It's sort of floated forward almost in this patient as well. But you'll also see it on the DV or VD view with these if you're taking them. And of course, you can get lots of small bits of gas working through colon and small intestine as well. But again, these cases are fairly classical when you see them. Now, to be fair, if you said, well, hang on a minute, what do I do if I've got a case and I'm not sure? either way, or a persistent gut stasis case that's taking its time to move, then we probably would be running some gastrographin or barium through these, mixed in with the oxbo. Sort of 10 mils per kilo would be our sort of limit. And in essence, you should get the stomach full of barium, but it should be spilling over into small intestine and cecum quite fast. And as time goes through, you'll get increased mixing in the stomach, so you'll get the less as it mixes with that ingester normally, and you'll get progressive cecal filling, really, over a couple of hours. And then pretty much overnight, you'll start getting pellets being produced through these. And the beauty, if you've got barium pellets, is it's very obvious when they start producing pellets that have barium in them. So the sort of signs that we'd see with these non-obstructive cases would be maybe a gradual reduction in appetite, progressively over time, maybe a bit of fur coming through, that sort of type thing. If anorexia is the problem here, that may be quite quick. And some of these can be presented suddenly as an emergency because the owner has suddenly noticed in the morning when they've gone down that there's been not much food eaten or not many feces passed, and that's the point they start to panic. So the main thing here normally would be a decreased output and size of fecal pellets. They'd be in pain, tooth grinding, hunching, lying on the floor, stretching out their belly, this sort of type thing. They might initially be quite bright, but progress through to being depressed, lethargic, becoming dehydrated, hypothermic, and obviously dying if they are left alone. So, again, get a history. Clinical exam, do your radiography, and do your blood work, whatever you feel you want to evaluate their metabolic status. This gut stasis rabbit here, we can tell is quite severe because I haven't eaten anything here, and these feces are teeny tiny, very, very small feces being produced. So lack of fiber going through here. Very obvious clinically that this rabbit is in need of some assistance with its GI tract. Now, if you've got a surgical case, then on clinical assessment and radiography, you'll have a compromised rabbit with a gastric dilatation. Blood glucose, sodium, arterial blood gas, whatever you like, if you feel the need to. But your radiography and clinical assessment will tell you the story. Rushing in surgically, we wouldn't do that. What we would do is stabilise this patient. And if I'm convinced these actually have a genuine, seriously compromised rabbit with severe pain that is a genuine surgical candidate, that I'm probably reaching for methadone or morphine here. Normally we'd be upgrading to that level because it's the pain that is of concern here. Non-steroidals, maybe in the first instance I might back away from because if it is dehydrated and we're risking ulceration and the blood pressure to kidneys has been low, maybe I don't want a non-steroidal first out. I'll push them with intravenous fluid therapy because they need it. And I might put some ranitidine across them as well as an ulcer protectant for these cases as well, just into the first sort of instance. What we do need for these, of course, is if the stomach is big and getting to the point of becoming compromised, is we need to decompress this patient. And just a couple of pictures here. Obviously, this one didn't make it, but you can just see the sheer size of stomach on this dead rabbit here. This is pain, shock, tympanic, very unpleasant looking rabbit. And this is how they kind of present. I mean, completely different to your gut stasis rabbit in terms of the way in which they are presenting to you. So we stomach tube these. What I would suggest with these is you do oxygenate that rabbit before you start. We use an otoscope comb, which we slide in the mouth. In so doing, you will flip up the soft palate, so you will be forcing that rabbit to mouth breathe to some extent. You're then using maybe a 6 or 8 French catheter to slide down into the esophagus and into stomach. Bear in mind, you want to make sure you're in the right place. You'll hear breath sounds coming out of your otoscope comb because you're flipping up the soft palate. In the right place with the stomach tube, you won't be hearing breath sounds, but you'll hear more sort of gagging sort of noises than breath sounds when you know you're in the right place with that tube. And then you can aspirate or use gravity to drain out contents. This is a variable success rate. If you drain the fluid and gas, great. If you hit a piece of fur pelt while you're suctioning this out, that will block the holes on your stomach tube very, very quickly. To alleviate that, you're going to have to put a little bit of back pressure just to ease those fur pelts off so you can get better access and draw in some more fluid. But in some cases, you do fail to get adequate decompression. But if you do get decompression and you do stabilize this patient, you might be buying yourself sufficient time that this fur pelt moves, or you're buying yourself sufficient time to get theatre set up and a much more stable patient that's under less respiratory compromise when it comes to anaesthesia. So they may spontaneously resolve and become medical cases. Medical cases may, of course, spontaneously get a blockage 1 hour after you've sent them home, for example. So we are very cautious of reevaluating their abdominal palpation and metabolic status throughout the time they are hospitalized. And if you're thinking of these and going, okay, if we're going to blame fur here, the good old classical wool block in the days of yore, what do we do about it? Because if I've got a fur pelt that's come through that's partly blocked and then moved through again, who's to say the next bit won't do it? Who's to say my rabbit, which currently is now nice and stable, is not going to groom a load more fur overnight and block come the morning? What about the next time they molt? So these cases, ironically, they are potentially critical throughout their entire stay with you. And there is a logic in saying, well, okay, if I am going to go in surgically and I've got to alleviate this blockage, fine, we'll go through how we would do that next for you. The question then is, do I want to evacuate the stomach contents? Because if I do, I'm getting rid of all of the fur, then I'm going to refill this rabbit with non-fur containing oxbow, give it a good groom, and then maybe we've got a clean slate. Maybe I'm trying to avoid this recurring. But the fact of the matter is, as I said, it's a long-term management and education that is more of concern here. So our aim for surgical intervention, being honest with you, is to move this blockage into the large intestine without opening the small intestine if we can. The question you have is, should I open the stomach? And I'll leave that for you to decide on how compromised your patient is. If we empty the stomach, we're removing more fur that could potentially re-block this creature. If we don't, surgery is much quicker, much less risk of infection, less morbidity. We just have to take it on the chin that maybe some more fur will want to come through. So if they're genuinely blocked, then okay, this is a surgical emergency. This is one that needs to be done. Normally, like I say, it's fur, occasionally carpet fibers, rubber plastic, and other causes, tumours, abscess, adhesions, less common, but these are all differentials on your list. So a poorly responding animal or non-responsive animal, you do want to be evaluating other causes for that. And what we don't want to get to the situation of is finding we have a rabbit with a stomach that is about to rupture and pop at surgery with a big necrotic area. This is an instant goodbye now. This sort of case is in more stable with us. We do have a tympanic stomach here, quite marked. So we are going to go through here in size on the greater curvature and basically then evaluate and evacuate the contents as much as we can do to decompress this rabbit, drain out the fluid completely from there, and then basically at that point we go down and check the pylorus, make sure that is clear, and if that's the case then we'll probably sew up the stomach at that time point. And it does depend whether you want to open up stomach first or second or not at all, but if you go in there first, sew it up afterwards to reduce your contamination, clean the area off, then move to evaluate the small intestine. If they're that tympanic, you're concerned about respiratory compromise. If they're not so tympanic, maybe you want to evaluate the small intestine first before you look at stomach. Now, when you evaluate the small intestine, like I say, you can have a blockage at any point down there. This particular case here, we've got a very clear necrotic area here with a piece of GI content sitting at this point, wedged, areas going black and necrotic. So this very clearly is an animal that's been obstructed to the point that this needs to be removed. And in some of these cases, you may have to go in and move it just past the area of the obstruction and remove that completely. Other cases, like I say, I'll be milking this all the way down through into the large intestine at all possible. And like I say, these tend to be silly little fur pelts. Occasionally, you'll get a lot more fur, and some will act like a linear foreign body. This is a again another rabbit's small intestine here, quite severe, and you can see the amount of distension of that small intestine that we have now got proximal to this blockage. This really, again, is another one that's going to have to be surgical here. And you can see it's quite an unpleasant amount of material that has been removed. And this is sort of a big risk of post-operative adhesions or peritonitis here as well. So be very critical with these on that cases. So all of these, like I say, have stomach distension. And this is very quite nice here that you've got a very lovely picture here of a fluid line here with a gas cap. And obviously, there's going to be fur and fiber and all sorts of stuff down amongst that food content. So, again, on this case, we're aspirating this post obstruction, emptying everything through, and then what we're doing is milking everything through that intestine. So, this is another one here. This is actually what caused the blockage, but we're milking this through down into cecum. I'm not opening up this particular case, milking it all the way down through. And again, you may be wanting to empty out contents as well. Try and minimize your risk of contamination for these. Pad everything off. You will want to make a big incision to evaluate the whole stomach contents if you're going to that far. And then, like I say, inverting Lambert sutures. We test fill these with Hartmann's, nice warm fluids. We fill the stomach with warm fluids, and we melt that through the entire pyloric outflow all the way down through into the cecum. So when we've finished with these, the rabbit basically has a stomach and small intestine full of electrolytes at that time point, which obviously is going to help keep things hydrated and improve the rabbit's situation as well. And then obviously, post-operatively for these sort of patients, they are going to be on the prokinetics. We'll go straight for syringe feeding. If you're concerned the rabbit's been compromised for quite some time, maybe that first feed you could consider switching onto maybe Emerade herbivore, or maybe a little bit of the Vetart critical care, maybe just to get a bit of extra glucose on board if you were worried about that patient in the first feed before pushing more fiber going through. That's fine, and we certainly will do that with some of the blocked rabbits that spontaneously unblock. We'll start more with electrolytes and fluids. Followed by maybe some simple carbohydrate before pushing more fiber through them, just to give chance for those gut contents to satisfactorily start being broken up and rehydrate and move through before we start loading more material into them. So prokinetics, we use our sisapride all the time with our ranitidine for these sort of cases where we're getting to the point of being, I guess, quite desperate to get things to move. Metoclopramide we do if we perceive we have protracted, delayed emptying of the small intestine and stomach, but again, would only be using that when we're happy that it's not obstructed. The last thing you want to be doing is putting a prokinetic in place there that's going to risk rupture. Metoclopramide also has the added benefit, of course, of acting centrally as well. We know that rabbits can't vomit, and the question is can they still be nauseous? And if that's the case, the metoclopramide might help settle that down. Domperidone really, to some extent, has fallen out of favor with us now with these sort of cases. Pineapple and papaya are used. Both of these are aimed at digesting hair. Obviously, there's commercial products marketed. They don't tend to work. We tend not to bother. I'd be more concerned about grooming than anything else. They do have sugar content as well, so do we really want to give them that? I suppose worst case scenario, if people are giving pineapple juice to their rabbit, they're rehydrating the gut contents. So maybe there is some positive effect. Maybe they feel like they're doing something, and that's also a positive thing as well. Simethicone, dimethicone, very commonly used. But these basically make a frothy bloat into one big gas cap. Most of these rabbits have a big gas cap, and because they cannot eructate, they cannot clear out this gas cap. It's got to be passed down through the entire GI tract, that gas, and as it does so, that is painful. Now, okay, in my head, I guess if I gave a rabbit a load of dimethicone or simethicone, I then subsequently decompressed it with a stomach tube, would the Infacol help me get more gas out? Maybe. But I'm not a fan. But you will see this commonly used by owners. It's a very sort of something they can get from the chemist and treat with. What I think we should be not underestimating is giving them some exercise. We get all of our gut stasis rabbits are out on our ward floor and encouraged to move around to get things moving. Abdominal massage is quite a big thing, same as in small children for colic. I don't know how effective you would be at manipulating the gas through quicker by doing that, particularly as it's cecal gas and it's got to come out of the ileocecal colic junction primarily here. And I'm not sure that repetitive compression of a gas-filled viscous is helpful or pain-free. But a lot of owners do abdominal palpation as a method for moving things along. And I guess you've got to gauge it on the case and how painful you feel they are. Nutritional support, of course, critically important for these cases once we're happy that it is appropriate based on our triage, radiography and assessment of that patient. Again, maybe some carbohydrates going in the first instance if you're worried about the ketosis, but obviously more fibrous food going through or stimulate back to normal motility is what they should be having as well. Give IV fluids, get it in balance as well. That's obviously critical need as well. Nasogastric tubes we rarely use because of the size. You're probably only going to get carbohydrates down. If the stomach is full of food content, it's got food content in its stomach. It's very rare that nasogastric tubes are of a major need for these cases. And it may take 3 days to get droppings to pass through again. And we just basically keep going until we've got them all coming through. Do the grooming, get the diet improved long-term for higher fibre. And what we're really looking for a rabbit that is recovering from GI stasis or surgery, is the bowl has been eaten, the hay has been destroyed, and I've got nice fecal pellets around my pen, and I've got urine being produced as well. This rabbit is rehydrated completely, passing normal pellets and consuming food. This one is ready to go home, basically. We do have a couple of questions. First question I've got coming through is our sort of protocol for analgesia for these. If I'm using methadone, we use a dose of really up to 0.5 mg per kg every 4 hours. You do tend to find that if you start pushing beyond that up to sort of 0.7 or 1, you can get some sedative effect on these patients as well, so just be a little bit concerned with that. For morphine, we're sort of more like the 2 to 4 mg per kg, probably starting at 2 for these, really, again every 4 hours. And the buprenorphine, we stick a standard dose of 0.03 mg per kg every 8 hours for them to get things moving. Second question is about calcium channel blockers and adhesions. There's been some nice studies in rats that have shown that actually the use of non-steroidals has a positive effect on adhesion formation. In the way of stopping them, that is, for 5 days post-surgery. So we do use non-steroidals for 5 days after surgery for these, along with the ranitidine for 5 days as well. Where we're worried about adhesions, we tend to be more small intestinal surgery, or where we've had to go in and alleviate existing adhesions and are fearing them reforming. Verapamil can be harder to get hold of these days, so we've used diltiazem for these diluted down for a calcium channel blocker to try and limit adhesion formation. Again, it's anecdotal, but we'd probably use it once every couple of 3 years. Whereas I think, you know, my standard sort of approach for these would be IV fluid therapy, opioid analgesia, non-steroidals, ranitidine, plus and minus metacam, and loads of oral fluids and nutritional support for them. Get them in a separate ward, get them quiet. Perform your radiography, perform your blood work, choose the cases that are surgical, monitor them very closely, and if they're non-responsive, once they are stable and become more normothermic, then it's an anaesthetic to go in and do the surgery. Final question that we've got is, what anaesthetic would we use for the surgical cases? And again, I think people are very easy. They get fall into a trap of, this is my rabbit anaesthetic. You know loads of premedicants. You know loads of analgesics. You know loads of induction agents and methods of maintaining anaesthesia. You just have to apply them and bespoke them to that individual patient. If we're concerned we've got marked cardiovascular and respiratory compromise, we will be avoiding alpha 2s, of course. So these would normally have a pure myopioid premed, and then we'd probably give a little bit of midazolam, maybe a little bit of ketamine to take the edge off them, muscle relaxation, that sort of type thing. Some of these, if we thought they were very painful, we might do a lidocaine bupivacaine block of the body wall when we're making the incision, again to try and minimize the depth of anaesthesia needed. And then we're probably using alfaxolone as our preferred induction agent these days to effect intubating, mechanically ventilating with a capnograph monitoring effectiveness of that ventilation, because these will be in respiratory compromise. And again, it's a question of severity of stomach distension, whether that's something you want to decompress straight away or something you want to evaluate after you've identified and found the reason for the blockage in that case. So this is the end of the webinar. I'm now going to pass you back to Eimear. Thanks very much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Kevin for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.